A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking what actually happens when professional asset managers move multi-million dollar sums. Like, do they have some souped-up version of online banking? Send 50 million button next to the pay electric bill button. The real question underneath it is, when the money being moved is huge, how does the actual task of sending it differ from what you and I do?
The mental image is hilarious. Some guy in a Patagonia vest clicking confirm transfer on a really fancy Venmo. But the reality is so much more interesting. And it matters right now because global institutional assets under management just hit $145 trillion in the first quarter of this year, according to BCG's Global Wealth Report. That's pension funds, sovereign wealth, endowments, hedge funds, all of it moving through plumbing most people never see.
$145 trillion. So if the plumbing breaks, it's not just some billionaire having a bad day. It's teachers' pensions failing to rebalance. It's market volatility spiking because a fund can't settle. The stakes are genuinely systemic.
And the core question is, when the money is that big, how does the actual task of sending it differ? The answer comes in three layers. First, the software layer, the actual systems these people use to enter and route orders. Second, the settlement layer, how money and securities actually move. And third, the human layer. The compliance checks, the dual authorization, the safeguards against what the industry charmingly calls fat finger errors.
The financial term for, oops, I just bought Denmark.
It's happened. We'll get there. So if it's not a souped-up banking app, what is it? Let's start with the software that actually runs the show.
Before we do, just to scope this, we're talking about professional asset managers, hedge funds, pension funds, mutual funds, sovereign wealth funds, the kind of entities that move anywhere from $1 million to over $1 billion in a single transaction. These are not people logging into Chase.com.
And the software they use falls into two big categories, order management systems, OMS, and execution management systems, EMS. The OMS is where the portfolio manager says, I want to buy $500 million of Apple stock. The EMS is where the trader actually goes and does it.
The OMS is the decision layer. The EMS is the action layer.
And the names you'll hear in the industry. Bloomberg AIM, which stands for Asset and Investment Manager, used by over 30,000 investment professionals globally. Charles River Development. And then there are the proprietary systems, the biggest of which is BlackRock's Aladdin.
Which sounds like a Disney ride, but is actually the nervous system of global finance.
Aladdin is a monster. It handles risk analytics, portfolio management, trading, compliance, all in one platform. Something like $20 trillion in assets sits on Aladdin. It's not an exaggeration to say that if Aladdin went down, large chunks of the global financial system would be flying blind.
Walk me through the actual workflow. A portfolio manager decides to make a trade. What happens next?
The portfolio manager generates an order in the OMS. That order doesn't just go straight to market. It first runs through a compliance pre-flight check. And this is the first place where the consumer intuition breaks down. Before any order reaches any exchange or any counterparty, it hits a rules engine that checks against the fund's entire mandate.
What kind of rules?
Position limits. Can't own more than 5% of any single company. Sector concentration. Can't have more than 15% of the portfolio in energy stocks. Liquidity constraints. Can't buy something so illiquid that you couldn't sell it in a crisis. Counterparty exposure limits. Regulatory restrictions specific to the jurisdiction.
This all happens before anyone actually tries to buy anything.
The compliance engine is integrated directly into the order flow. If the trade violates any rule, it's blocked automatically. The trader never even sees it. This is fundamentally different from consumer banking, where the only pre-check is, do you have enough money in the account?
which is a binary yes-no question. This is a multidimensional constraint satisfaction problem.
Once the order clears compliance, it lands in the trader's blotter. The blotter is a real-time list of pending orders, what to buy, what to sell, how much, any special instructions. And this is where the interface starts looking less like a banking app and more like a fighter jet cockpit.
Multiple screens, real-time data streams, probably some blinking lights that would give me a headache.
Bloomberg Terminal is the classic, four screens, color-coded, real-time quotes, news feeds, chat windows. But on top of that, the trader is running an EMS like FlexTrade or Portware. The EMS is where the actual execution strategy happens.
Execution strategy is about not announcing to the entire market that you're about to buy $500 million of something.
That's the whole game. If you just dump a $500 million buy order onto the New York Stock Exchange, the price will spike before you've bought even a tenth of what you need. Everyone sees the order, algorithms jump in front of you, and by the time you're done, you've paid way more than you should have.
How do you hide an order that big?
And this is the key aha moment. An iceberg order shows only a small fraction of the total size to the market, typically 10 to 20%. The rest is hidden. As the visible portion gets filled, the system automatically replenishes it from the hidden reserve. The market sees a series of small orders, not one giant one.
Like an actual iceberg, 90% below the surface.
And for a $500 million equity order, the trader isn't just placing one iceberg order. They're breaking it into 50 to 100 smaller child orders, each routed to different venues, exchanges, dark pools, broker algorithms, over hours or even days.
Not ominous at all.
Dark pools are private exchanges, where institutional investors can trade large blocks of stock without revealing their intentions to the public market. They're completely legal and heavily regulated. The idea is that if two big institutions want to trade with each other, they can do it in a dark pool without moving the market for everyone else.
It's a back alley for whales. Respectable back alley.
With lots of lighting and security cameras. But the other piece of execution strategy is the algorithm. Most large orders use something called a VWAP algorithm, volume, weighted average price. The algorithm looks at historical trading patterns and spreads the order out over the day to match the average price. The goal isn't to get the best possible price, it's to not move the market.
Don't make waves is the prime directive.
There are other algorithms too. Implementation shortfall algorithms try to minimize the difference between the decision price and the execution price. Percentage of volume algorithms limit participation to a set fraction of market volume. The trader selects the algorithm based on the urgency of the trade, the liquidity of the stock, and the market conditions.
The trader isn't actually clicking buy and sell in the way a retail investor does. They're configuring a strategy and letting the algorithms execute it.
And this is where the 2010 flash crash becomes a cautionary tale. On May 6, 2010, a single large sell order, something like $4 billion in S&P futures, was executed too aggressively using an algorithm that only cared about volume, not price or time. It triggered a cascade of automated selling that wiped out nearly $1 trillion in market value in about 36 minutes before recovering.
One aggressive algorithm nearly broke the entire U.S. stock market.
The response was circuit breakers and kill switches. Modern trading systems have automatic halts if a stock moves too far too fast. Individual traders have kill buttons that instantly cancel all outstanding orders. The whole infrastructure is designed around the assumption that things will go wrong, and when they do, you need to be able to stop everything immediately.
The kill switch as a design philosophy. I like it. When in doubt, unplug.
That's just the execution side. So the trade is executed. The shares are bought, the bonds are sold, but the money hasn't actually moved yet. This is where consumer intuition really breaks down, because settlement is a completely different world from execution.
We've done the trade. Everyone's agreed on price and quantity.
Now we enter the settlement layer. And this is where we need to talk about the three big systems that actually move money between institutions, Fedwire, CHIPS, and SWIFT.
Break it down.
Fedwire is the big one for U.S. dollars. It's operated by the Federal Reserve, and it handles real-time gross settlement. Real-time means the transfer happens immediately. Gross settlement means each transaction settles individually. No batching, no netting. When a transfer goes through Fedwire, it's final and irrevocable. The sender's reserve account at the Fed is debited. The receiver's is credited.
It's instantaneous.
The actual transfer settles in seconds. But, and this is the crucial, but it only happens after hours of pre-validation. We'll get to that. The scale is staggering. Fedwire processed about $1 quadrillion in transfers last year. That's $1,000 trillion. It averages about $4 trillion per business day.
$4 trillion a day. That's the GDP of Germany moving through a single system every 48 hours.
CHIPS, the Clearinghouse Interbank Payment System, handles about $1.8 trillion a day. CHIPS is different from Fedwire because it's a netting system. Instead of settling each transaction individually, it batches transactions throughout the day and nets them out. At the end of the day, only the net positions are settled via Fedwire.
CHIPS is like splitting a restaurant bill among 20 people. You figure out who owes what, and only the differences actually change hands.
And then there's SWIFT. SWIFT is the one everyone's heard of, and it's also the one everyone misunderstands.
SWIFT is not a settlement system.
SWIFT is not a settlement system. It's a messaging network. It's the system that tells banks what to do. Please transfer X amount from account A to account B. The actual money movement happens through Fedwire for dollars, through CA chips for batch dollars, or through local real-time gross settlement systems for other currencies. SWIFT is the postal service, not the bank account.
When you hear SWIFT transfer, what you're actually hearing is a transfer initiated via SWIFT messages that settles through something else entirely.
And this is one of the big misconceptions. People think SWIFT moves money. It doesn't. It moves instructions. The money itself moves through central bank systems.
Which is why sanctions that cut someone off from SWIFT are effective. You're not cutting off their money. You're cutting off their ability to tell banks what to do with it.
Now, there's another piece of the settlement puzzle that's been through a massive change recently, the settlement timeline for securities. As of May 28, 2024, the U.S. moved from T+2 to T+1 settlement.
T+1 meaning the trade settles one business day after the trade date.
For decades, when you bought a stock, you had 3 days for the money and the shares to actually change hands. Then in 2017, it went to 2 days. Then in May 2024, it went to 1 day. And Europe is moving to T+1 in 2027.
Why compress it?
Every day between trade and settlement is a day where something can go wrong. The counterparty could go bankrupt. The market could move against you. The longer the gap, the more capital you have to set aside as collateral. Compressing to T+1 reduced the margin requirements for the clearinghouses by something like 25%.
It also means you have less time to fix errors,
which forced massive infrastructure upgrades. Settlement systems that used to run overnight batch processes now have to handle everything within hours. Custodian banks like State Street and BNY Mellon had to rebuild their workflows. It was a multi-year, multi-billion dollar project across the entire industry.
Let's get concrete. Walk me through a $100 million wire transfer. What actually happens?
The fund's custodian bank, let's say State Street, initiates the transfer through Fedwire. But before that initiation happens, there's a whole sequence of steps. The fund's operations team confirms the trade details. The settlement instructions are matched with the counterparty's instructions. This is called affirmation, and it happens through the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation for U.S. Securities. Any discrepancy in the amount, the account number, the settlement date, and the whole thing stops.
The money doesn't move until both sides agree on every detail.
Once the trade is affirmed, the custodian verifies that the fund actually has the cash or the securities. Then the transfer is queued for release, and this is where the human layer kicks in.
The human layer, my favorite layer, the one that contains error.
Dual authorization is mandatory for transactions above a threshold, typically $1 million. Two senior people must independently verify and approve every transfer. Some firms require 3 signatures above $50 million. This isn't optional. It's baked into the compliance framework and audited.
Somewhere out there, right now, there are 2 or 3 people staring at a screen, verifying a $100 million transfer.
They're checking everything. The counterparty name against a pre-approved list. The account number. The settlement date. The purpose of the payment. Any new counterparty requires callback verification. Someone literally picks up the phone and calls a known number at the receiving institution to confirm the wiring instructions.
For $100 million. the highest stakes game of telephone.
It exists because of incidents like the Citigroup Revlon error. Citigroup was acting as administrative agent for a loan to Revlon. They were supposed to send about $8 million in interest payments to Revlon's lenders. Instead, they accidentally sent $900 million, the entire principal amount of the loan.
$900 million, not $8
million. A junior employee entered the wrong field in the payment system. The dual authorization check failed to catch it because the system showed the correct total amount, but the wrong breakdown of principal versus interest. The approvals looked right at the summary level.
The system showed the number people expected to see, so they approved it.
Then the real nightmare began. Some of the lenders refused to return the money, arguing they were entitled to it. Citigroup had to go to court. It took 2 years and a federal appeals court ruling to get the bulk of it back. The judge ultimately ruled that the lenders knew, or should have known, the transfer was a mistake, but the whole thing exposed how fragile the human verification layer can be.
Even with dual authorization, even with all the systems, a single data entry error can send $900 million into the void.
That's why modern safeguards keep layering on. Positive Pay. The fund sends a list of expected payments to the custodian bank, and the bank only honors transfers that match the list. AI-based anomaly detection that flags transactions outside normal patterns. This fund has never sent money to an account in this jurisdiction before. Payee name verification that matches the name on the receiving account, not just the account number.
The name matching is interesting because account numbers are just strings. There's nothing inherently meaningful about them. Adding semantic verification. Does this name match this number? Closes a whole category of errors.
The UK has been leading on this with something called confirmation of pay. Since 2020, UK banks check that the name on the receiving account matches what the sender entered before the transfer goes through. The US is behind on this, though the Federal Reserve has been exploring it.
There's an asymmetry. The UK has name verification. The US mostly doesn't, which means US wire transfers are still vulnerable to the wrong account number error in a way UK transfers aren't.
And this connects to the FTX collapse in late 2022. FTX had none of this infrastructure. No proper custodian bank, no dual authorization, no segregation of customer and corporate funds. Sam Bankman-Fried and a handful of others could move customer money with essentially no checks. $8 billion in customer funds were misappropriated.
That's the Citigroup error times nine, but intentional.
It's a cautionary tale of what happens when institutional safeguards are absent. All the systems we've been describing, the OMS, the EMS, the compliance pre-checks, the custodian banks, the dual authorization, the settlement infrastructure, none of it existed at FTX. It was a consumer-grade operation handling institutional-scale money.
The crypto industry's whole pitch was cut out the middlemen, the banks, the custodians, the clearinghouses, and FTX demonstrated why those middlemen exist.
Some of them, anyway. The challenge is that these systems create a fundamental tension. Markets demand instant execution. The trader needs to act now before the opportunity disappears. But settlement requires verification. You need to confirm identities, check compliance, validate instructions. Speed and safety are in direct conflict.
The entire institutional infrastructure is a negotiation between those two forces. How fast can we go without breaking things?
And that negotiation is what produces all the complexity we've been describing. The consumer banking interface is designed to hide complexity. You click send and the money moves. The institutional interface is designed to expose complexity because every step needs to be verifiable, auditable, and reversible if something goes wrong.
The souped-up online banking intuition is wrong not just because the software looks different, but because the fundamental problem is different. When I send money on Venmo, I'm sending it to someone I know. When a pension fund sends $100 million to a counterparty, they may never have dealt with that specific entity before. They need to verify identity, check compliance, manage settlement risk, and create an audit trail that will hold up in court.
That's the key insight. Consumer transfers are about convenience. Institutional transfers are about control and auditability. The entire system is designed around the assumption that errors will happen, disputes will arise, and regulators will come asking questions. Every step has to be reconstructable after the fact.
Which is also why these systems feel slow from the outside. The money doesn't actually take days to move. Fedwire settles in seconds. The delay is all the pre-transfer verification, the compliance checks, the dual authorization, the counterparty validation, the settlement instruction matching. You're not waiting for the money to travel. You're waiting for everyone to agree that it should.
That's a misconception worth busting. People think large transfers take days because the money is moving through the system. It's not. The money moves instantly. The days are spent making sure it's moving to the right place for the right reason.
Like a space launch. The rocket itself takes minutes to reach orbit. The years of engineering and checklists and go-no-go decisions happen before you light the candle.
And once you understand this, you start seeing the institutional payment infrastructure everywhere. When the U.S. debt ceiling crisis was playing out in 2023, one of the terrifying scenarios was that Treasury securities settlement could break down. If the Treasury couldn't make payments, the entire Fedwire system for government securities would seize up. That's not just a problem for bond traders, it's a problem for money market funds, for pension funds, for anyone holding Treasuries as collateral.
The plumbing is invisible until it breaks. Then suddenly everyone's an expert on settlement infrastructure.
The most important, boring thing in the world.
We've seen the software, the settlement systems, and the human safeguards. What does all of this mean for someone who's not moving $100 million a day?
This is the practical piece. Most listeners will never manage a hedge fund, but they might sell a house, receive an inheritance, or buy a business. Those are six-figure or seven-figure transactions, and they use the same infrastructure we've been describing, just the consumer version of it.
When your bank says we can do a wire transfer, what should you actually ask?
First, ask about cutoff times for same-day settlement. Fedwire operates from 9 p.m. Eastern the previous evening until 7 p.m. Eastern on the settlement day. If you miss the cutoff, your money moves the next business day. Different banks have different internal cutoffs that are earlier than the Fedwire deadline.
Same day doesn't mean any time today.
It usually means before 2 p.m. if you wanted to actually go out today. Second, ask whether the recipient's bank uses Fedwire directly or goes through a correspondent bank. If the receiving bank doesn't have a FedMaster account, which is true for many smaller banks and credit unions, the transfer has to go through an intermediary. That adds time and another point of potential failure.
Another set of fees, probably.
Third, if you're transferring securities, stocks, bonds, fund shares, ask whether you need a medallion signature guarantee. This is a special certification that your signature is genuine, provided by a bank or brokerage that participates in the medallion program. It's required for transferring physical securities or changing ownership on large accounts. Most people have never heard of it until they need one.
The medallion signature guarantee, the financial equivalent of a notary who goes to the gym.
It's actually backed by a surety bond. The guaranteeing institution is on the hook if the transfer turns out to be fraudulent. That's why they're so hard to get. The bank is literally insuring your signature.
For the big transactions in normal life, house sale, inheritance, business purchase, the advice is know your cutoff times, know your correspondent banks, and know whether you need a medallion guarantee. Three questions that most people don't know to ask.
That's the broader point. The infrastructure that moves institutional money is invisible but critical to market functioning. When it works, nobody notices. When it breaks, the entire financial system feels it. The institutional systems exist because the consequences of errors are catastrophic in a way that consumer errors aren't. If I accidentally Venmo the wrong person $50, it's annoying. If a pension fund accidentally wires $900 million to the wrong lender, it's a two-year court battle and a federal appeals ruling.
That's the thread that ties the whole thing together. The complexity isn't there because institutions like complexity. It's there because the stakes demand it. Every layer, the compliance pre-checks, the iceberg orders, the dual authorization, the settlement matching, the anomaly detection, exists because someone, somewhere, at some point, made a catastrophic error and the industry said, never again.
The entire institutional financial infrastructure is a museum of past disasters curated into safeguards.
Which brings us to the big open question. As real-time payment systems expand globally, FedNow in the US, TIPS in Europe, will the institutional and consumer payment infrastructure ever converge? Or will the safety requirements always demand separate systems?
FedNow is interesting because it's the Federal Reserve's real-time payment system for consumers and businesses. It launched in July 2023 and it allows instant 24/7 transfers. In theory, that could eventually replace some of the wire transfer infrastructure. But FedNow has a transaction limit of $500,000, deliberately set to keep it in the consumer and small business space, not the institutional space.
The Fed itself is maintaining the separation.
The other wild card is blockchain-based settlement. The Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation has been running something called Project Ion, a blockchain-based settlement system for equities. It processed its first trades in 2022. But as of mid-2026, it handles less than 1% of institutional volume. The technology works, but the existing infrastructure is so deeply embedded that migration is a multi-decade project.
The existing infrastructure, for all its complexity, actually works. Fedwire settles in seconds. The error rate is vanishingly small. The Citigroup incident made headlines precisely because it was so rare. You don't rip out infrastructure that processes $250 billion a year without being very sure the replacement is better.
The blockchain pitch is that it reduces reconciliation costs. In the current system, every institution maintains its own ledger, and they have to reconcile with each other constantly. A shared ledger would eliminate that. But the speed argument doesn't hold. Fedwire is already real-time and final. Blockchain isn't faster for settlement. It's potentially cheaper for reconciliation.
The future isn't blockchain replaces Fedwire. It's more like blockchain reduces the back office cost of keeping everyone's books in sync.
That's the realistic take, and it's why the DTCC's Project Ion is focused on the clearing and settlement layer, not the payment layer. They're not trying to replace Fedwire. They're trying to make the reconciliation between trading counterparties more efficient.
To wrap this up, next time you hear about a $10 billion fund rebalancing, remember it's not a button click. It's a choreographed dance of software, settlement systems, and human verification, all designed to make the impossible look routine.
The souped-up online banking mental model is exactly backwards. Consumer banking hides complexity to make things easy. Institutional banking exposes complexity to make things safe.
The difference between a light switch and a nuclear reactor control room, both turn things on. Only one needs to prevent meltdowns.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1880s, French colonial administrators in Chad inadvertently caused the extinction of several local sign language dialects. They consolidated deaf students from dozens of ethnic groups into a single school in Fort Lamy, imposing a standardized French-based sign system. Within one generation, the regional dialects, which had evolved independently in isolated villages for centuries, were gone, replaced by a colonial lingua franca that none of the students' families could understand.
Colonialism managed to colonize sign language too. Of course it did.
Deeply unsettling, and I have no follow-up.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps. We're at myweirdprompts.com. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. The money moves in seconds. The safeguards take days.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.